You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, North Korea has launched a new round of missile tests and a new round of threats. We'll get the latest on U.S. relations with North and South Korea. Now, emails and texts from Fox News executives and personalities seem to directly contradict some of the news organization's own coverage of the 2020 presidential election. The messages released last week come from a defamation lawsuit filed by Dominion Voting Systems seeking $1.6 billion in damages. Dominion says these messages show that Fox News kept broadcasting untrue information because they feared losing viewers. In its defense, Fox News says that its reporting and commentary were legitimate news-gathering activities protected under the First Amendment. Our next guest has been following the lawsuit and the inner workings of Fox News. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch Fox News? Do you watch the news part of it, the commentary part in the evenings? What's your opinion of their reporting and their talk show hosts? When should a media outfit be liable if they are reporting false information, if they're doing it knowingly? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Wemple is the media critic for The Washington Post. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
Can you briefly bring us up to speed on this Dominion Voting Systems lawsuit against Fox News?
Of course. Yes, it was in 2021, early 2021, when Dominion Voting Systems filed this lawsuit against Fox News. The lawsuit relates to a bunch of statements made on the air at Fox News, basically in the weeks after the 2020 presidential election, statements in which Fox News guests and hosts said stuff about the 2020 election, allegations that it was stolen, of course, repeating President Trump's claims. And in many of these cases, they sort of swept in a conspiracy theory that voting machines made by Dominion Voting Systems, a U.S. firm, were used to flip votes from President Trump to President Biden. There was also a lot of chatter that Smartmatic, which makes software also for voting systems and other voting technology, was involved in the same sort of racket. In just about all cases, the representations about these two voting firms on Fox News were false. And both of the voting firms sued for big money. I believe it was $1.6 billion for Dominion and more for Smartmatic. But it was, it's this idea that they basically defamed these two companies by making false and damaging statements about their business. And the claim is that these businesses are irreparably harmed into the future as a result.
Now, here we are here we are with this this brief from Dominion Voting Systems, and their case are revealing a lot of what they saw in internal communications behind the scenes at Fox News. This is executives, this is on-air hosts, news department, and more. There's a lot here. What struck you the most in seeing what Dominion had included in this brief?
Well, what struck me most was that finally someone had pierced the veil of Fox News. For years, reporters and lawsuits, lawyers and so on and so forth have tried to get behind the scenes to find out what was really going on there. This is the most intrusive look at Fox News, the most insightful sort of discovery venture legally that's ever been done at Fox News, as far as I can see. And what struck me the most was simply what struck just about everybody was the fact that the Fox News hosts and executives who were allowing these falsehoods to be aired on Fox News, well, they didn't believe them. It's one thing under U.S. libel law to say false things that you believe, in other words, just to make honest mistakes, but these were not honest mistakes. These were dishonest mistakes, according to this brief. And this is the brief that we're talking about just a week ago. It comes after months of discovery in which Fox News had to turn over texts and emails and documents to Dominion.
Now, the motivation here is interesting from the journalistic side of this. There's kind of a legal and a journalistic side here. Again and again, some of these executives and hosts are looking at Fox viewers after Fox calls Arizona for Joe Biden. And in other instances, viewers, according to the ratings, moving over to Newsmax and One America News, which had no reservations about sharing a lot of these conspiracy theories. What was the response from executives and hosts to that loss of viewers and how they tried to, I think the phrase thread the needle kept coming up?
Yeah, it was panic. It was panic. Look, the thing about Fox News is that ever since 2002, when they became the number one cable news outlet as measured by ratings, it's something they've just been touting and bragging about and trumpeting every single day. It is their identity. Ratings is their identity. If they did not have ratings, they would not have much to fall back on because they don't come up with a lot of scoops. They're basically, as you suggested in the beginning, a talk show network. And so if they're not pulling down the ratings, they don't have much. So when they started seeing viewers who wanted to see this stolen election narrative, when they started to see those viewers desert them because Fox News was giving too much of the real story, they panicked. And the threading the needle, what that is all about, is trying to not defame people and trying not to go over too far out on the edge, but while at the same time leaving open this possibility that, yeah, Donald Trump really did get screwed in the election. There was electoral fraud and much. You know, it's just trying to play this middle game and trying to appease both sides. And that was obviously disastrous.
We're talking to Eric Wemple, media critic for The Washington Post, looking at documents released in this lawsuit from Dominion Voting Systems against Fox News for defamation. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. If you've been following this, your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Mike is with us in Sun Prairie. Mike, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Mike?
Well, I think that Fox News should be held accountable the same way that Donald Trump should be held accountable for the lies that he perpetrated the entire time that he was in office.
Mike, thanks for the call. Eric, let's talk about some of the legal side of this. The bar for, and you're starting to touch on this, the bar for holding a news outlet accountable for something like defamation, it's pretty high. Based on what we've seen in past cases, high-profile cases, what do we have to prove to say, yeah, this news outlet owes money to this person or in this case, this business they've defamed?
Right. Well, for the purposes of this case, the judge has ruled that Dominion is basically a public figure for the purposes of defamation law. And that's a term of art that's proprietary to defamation law. And it means that if you are a public figure, you have a very difficult time of proving damages and getting damages in a defamation action. The public figure standard was crafted by the Supreme Court back in the 60s in 1964, basically with the notion that, hey, if you are out there exposing yourself to public scrutiny as a politician, you shouldn't be able to just like go and sue every media outlet that makes an accidental mistake. Right? That the mistake has to be willing, somehow like a knowing or willing falsehood, or it has to be reckless disregard, which under this doctrine is very hard to prove. So the idea here is that this is the sort of law that enables us in the United States to have a real, really kind of an open, no holds barred public discourse. And you don't have to worry about Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, whatever, suing you every time you make a disparaging comment about them that could be false. In other words, falsehoods about people who invite scrutiny are okay, but knowing damaging falsehoods against those people are not okay. So that the latter basket is what Dominion has to prove here, has to prove that Fox not only said damaging false things, but they did so with a certain state of mind.
Right. There's a case where Sarah Palin, former Alaska governor, had sued the New York Times, which in a column did make a false statement about her that could be read certainly as disparaging. They did it once. They corrected it. They did an apology the next day. What looks different in the case that Dominion is presenting from a case like that, which ultimately was unsuccessful?
Yeah, ultimately what the jury ruled against Palin, and this, by the way, is a great example, and you've abridged it 100% correctly. The difference here, I think the main difference, is the Times thing was one-off, right? This was one editorial that was written, I believe, in June 2017. One editorial, a few sentences, boom. And that's all it was. And there was a correction. And when Palin got the New York Times to give up their emails and their correspondence, text messages, and so on and so forth, it revealed that these people made a mistake, that they screwed up. That they said that Sarah Palin, that this person who had engaged in the rampage was completely in his own world, his own delusional world, and was not connected to anything that Sarah Palin may have planted in his head through a patent, her super PAC or whatever. But this stuff with Dominion is repeated. I mean, one of the reasons why these complaints from these two voting technology companies are so long, they're hundreds and hundreds of pages, is because there's so much material there. Fox News did this repeatedly. The number of allegedly defamatory statements is marathonic. So that is, I would say that's the major difference here, which is the volume. Major difference between Fox, the Dominion case and the Palin case is the volume of allegedly defamatory statements. And I think the amount of sheer evidence in the latest filing about what Fox knew about the situation at hand.
Eric Wemple. Eric Wemple is with us, media critic at The Washington Post, looking at behind-the-scenes documents from Fox News revealed in a defamation lawsuit filed by the voting machine company Dominion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have these revelations changed your opinion of Fox News or reinforced it? What questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Eric Wemple, media critic for The Washington Post, looking at recent revelations from Dominion Voting Systems' defamation lawsuit against Fox News over the aftermath of the 2020 election and why some Fox News personalities were broadcasting claims that behind the scenes they said were not true. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. That's 800-642-1234. Just one example here. I want to give a listen to Fox News host Sean Hannity on his TV show. This is November 30th of 2020, talking with Donald Trump's attorney, Sidney Powell.
I've gone over everything I've been able to find out. Nobody liked Dominion Voting Systems. Nobody. Has anybody forensically examined these machines since the election?
We have only been allowed access to a few of them. We've got evidence of corruption all across the country in countless districts. They used the machines to trash large batches of votes that should have been awarded to President Trump.
So a big claim there and often heard on Fox News in that era, according to these filings. What were Fox News personalities saying about Sidney Powell, herself, her sources, and her claims?
Well, behind the scenes, they were saying complete BS. And worse, they were saying, you know, it's just she's nuts, BS, nothing to them, baseless allegations. But they had her on over and over again, and they were careful, you know, once in a while. And Fox lawyers have made this point. Once in a while, they asked her to supply evidence, and Tucker Carlson said, you know, we need to see evidence from you. He was possibly the most skeptical toward her, but she kept on getting on. And other people who were also, you know, trading in this sort of talk were on all the time. Dominion and Smartmatic were mentioned in this vein. And the statements, you know, that were made were really damning towards Fox News, even if they don't get a lot of money out of a jury award or a settlement or whatever. Journalistically, this is I mean, it's a major scandal for Fox News. Of course, there's a major scandal, it seems, for Fox News every month. So,
yeah, one of the weirdest bits, Eric, when asked for information, Sidney Powell provided an email to one of the shows quoting one of her sources here. This is a source for some of Sidney Powell's claims in the election. I'm quoting here. Who am I and how do I know all of this? I've had the strangest dreams since I was a little girl. I was internally decapitated and yet I live. The wind tells me I'm a ghost, but I don't believe it. And the source goes on to say she can get information because she can, quote, time travel in a semi-conscious state, end quote.
Yep. 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 That's a source document, right? That's a source document. If that counts as a source document at Fox News. So, you know, in the filing, you see that, you know, I think it was Bartiromo or one of the other hosts was saying, you know, obviously that was complete garbage, but, you know, doesn't seem to matter. You know, when you don't have standards for your journalism or your news reports day in and day out, you know, when a crunch time comes, like this is really crunch time for this network. Everything can go, you know, everything goes right out the window. So this is really remarkable. I think that even for people like myself, I've been covering Fox News for more than a decade and a lot of others, you know, this was even shocking to us.
Let's go back to our callers. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi, how are you doing? I think I'm timely on this. I can give you, I'm a real source. I'm not decapitated. I'm a live person. And I worked in New York City elections for several years. And because I have a computer background, I was in charge of the scanning machines. It was the first time I started from the first, we got this Midwestern firm. I don't know whether it's Dominion, but I assume most of them run by scanning. Anyway, so there was only one box at the bottom for the good ballots. The people put their ballot in, it scanned it, it gave it a number, it dropped in the locked box that had been examined at the beginning of the day to make sure there were no papers in there. It never was unlocked. At the end of the night, I and a police officer witnessed me pulling the box out that it was locked. I handed the box to the police officer. I was the only one who touched it. He and I both signed a form that we had both received it, that I had handed it to him, and I took that form home. So I consider that kind of misreporting also defamation to me, endangerment perhaps to me in future elections, and harassment.
Okay, thanks for the call. General harassment of election workers, Kay is worried about. If there were specific election workers who were targeted by a media outlet, would a different standard apply? Would they be considered public figures in this kind of case, Eric, in a hypothetical lawsuit by somebody like Kay who felt they'd been targeted?
Yeah, well, like certainly the media defense firm would try to bootstrap them into public figures. And there is a pretty broad and liberal category called limited purpose public figures. And those are people who have sort of thrown themselves into some controversy. But it's really, really, it would be really, really hard to make the case that elections night volunteer would be a public figure. I think that that person would remain a private figure throughout. It's an interesting sort of formulation. It's an interesting process for deciding that, but you know, the you really have to want to be in the public limelight. That is sort of like you need to expect to be in the limelight. I don't think an elections night volunteer would.
Okay, thanks a lot for sharing that. Yordis joins us next in Colfax. Yordis, hello.
Hello. I think Dominion has every right to sue because this is their business and they have been defamed. I mean, these lies that were perpetuated constantly by Fox could kill their business, destroy it. And that is jobs for people. It also insults everyone that works for that company as if there are, you know, people inside manipulating and doing trickery to create false votes. And anyway, it's an attack on democracy, ultimately. And these people, they don't have a conscience at Fox. They don't have a conscience. It's shocking.
Yordis, thanks for the call. Yordis making the point that Dominion isn't just arguing that Fox was knowingly wrong, but that it did substantial monetary damage to them. That's part of the story. The part of the case they're making, Eric.
Is that a question for me?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Right. The Dominion is saying that there are damages relating to their future business and so on and so forth. I think that the most convincing part of the Fox argument is that the damages, the Dominion is having trouble to proving all these damages. Now, the damages part can get really, really complicated with all sorts of different sorts of damage, presumed damage, actual damage, punitive damages, so on and so forth. It gets really complicated. But the nub of the Fox News argument is that this company is worth like tens of millions of dollars, not even worth $100 million. So the idea that they could be claiming $1.6 billion as a damages claim, as a total damages claim, is just ridiculous. And, you know, I don't think anybody out there really thinks that there's going to be a $1.6 billion forked over at any point. But it is the $1.6 billion, I think, does represent how huge the journalistic outrages and atrocities are.
Thanks for that call. Just in our last half a minute or so, Eric, does it matter for the future of Fox? Are Fox's followers going to look at this and say, we hate this deception, or are they going to stick with the network, do you think?
You know, that's a great question to end on. You know, for years and years, people are always tempted to say, this could be the undoing of Fox, or this could really bring Fox down, and, you know, something like that. My default has always been never, ever to overblow anything that happens at Fox on the scandalous side, because they are rugged. They can bounce back from anything. In fact, you could make the argument that all the scandals they've endured over the years, all the scandals that they themselves have generated, have boosted viewership. And that whenever you find, you know, outlets like Wisconsin Public Radio, Washington Post, you know, outlets that are associated with mainstream and establishment causes, hammering Fox, that only helps their audience. We're stuck with Fox. This can be a big embarrassment for them. It could mean some changes to how they operate, but Fox will be Fox.
Thanks to our guest, Eric Wempel, media critic for The Washington Post, looking at internal discussions that took place at Fox News, how those discussions appear to contradict some of their own reporting about the 2020 presidential election. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, relief efforts in Wisconsin for the Turkey and Syria earthquake. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Thanks to everybody who donated during our winter member drive. All the programs you enjoy are possible because people like you generously support it. If you missed the drive, join tens of thousands of dedicated WPR members with your gift right now at WPR.org. And thank you. Now, North Korea hasn't been front and center in U.S. foreign policy news lately after the expanded Russian invasion of Ukraine and tensions with China. But North Korean leadership is making a bid to change that. Over the last few weeks, the country has launched a series of missile tests, including short-range missiles that could threaten South Korea and Japan, and a longer-range missile that analysts say could potentially reach the United States. And North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un has issued nuclear threats in response to planned military training exercises in South Korea, including U.S. and South Korean troops. Our next guest is a Wisconsin expert on U.S. relations with North and South Korea, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the latest news and the long-running tensions between the U.S. and North Korea? What would you want to see from U.S. leadership in the region? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. David Fields, Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison. He's the author of Foreign Friends, Syngman Rhee, American Exceptionalism, and the Division of Korea. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me back, Rob. I really enjoy it.
Let's talk about these new missile tests. As I mentioned, one long range, some shorter range ones. What do you make of the tests and the timing?
Yeah, so I think there's primarily two reasons why North Korea tests missiles. The first is to advance their own missile technology to make sure that if at some point in the future they want to deliver a nuclear warhead somewhere, that they will actually be able to do it and that missile will function. And then they also test them as a sort of messaging, usually a way to send a signal to the United States or the ROK or perhaps the UN Security Council, that they are unhappy with something that has just happened. And the tests that we saw last weekend, and actually my phone just pinged about a few minutes ago, and there was another test probably within the last hour. These are clearly a bit of both. And we know that because the North Korean Foreign Ministry spokesman, as well as Kim Yo-jung, Kim Jong-un's younger sister, said so quite explicitly late last week. And they said that these tests are in response to the announced US-ROK joint military exercises and tabletop drills. The tabletop exercise happened in the Pentagon this last Wednesday, and the joint military exercises will happen in March. So this is clearly a response to that. But it, I think it's also clearly a signal that they are determined to continue developing their missile technology. So just for some context, since 1984, North Korea has tested or conducted 229 missile tests. 69 of those happened in 2022. So fully 30% of their missile tests happened within the last year. And they're testing various types of missiles. They're testing various types of engines for those missiles. And it seems pretty clear that this testing is designed to make sure that they have a credible delivery system for their nuclear weapons, should they ever choose to use them. They're not putting all their eggs in one particular type of missile technology. And it requires a lot of testing to make sure they have a viable system.
Now, those U.S. Republic of Korea, what we often call South Korea, those military exercises. Now, these kind of military exercises, I assume, have gone on for decades with U.S. troops and South Korean troops training for potential North Korean invasion. Is there anything particularly different about this one coming up in the spring?
No, there isn't. And this is such an interesting topic. And you're right, they have gone on for decades, but they change constantly. Some of them are very, very large scale, you know, involving thousands of forces from both sides using live fire. And some of them are actually, like I referred to, the ones that happened at the Pentagon on Wednesday are tabletop exercises. So they involve a very small number of, you know, high-ranking USROK officials and basically go through different scenarios. And how do we respond? How do we game out what we do in these situations? And they involve no troop movements at all. And I find this topic so interesting. And if your listeners find it interesting, I encourage you to check out a podcast on the nknews.org podcast with a retired Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Tharp, who is involved in these trainings for years. And he goes through the different kinds of trainings that have been done, the different iterations from the very large to the very small. But one point I want to highlight about these exercises is North Korea claims that these are very threatening to their security. And to a certain extent, that's understandable. But at the same time, these tests are announced. They're announced weeks in advance. The North Koreans know that they're going to happen. Most of them do not happen anywhere near the DMZ. And this is done very much out in the open. And that is in great contrast to North Korean missile tests, which often the first news of a missile test comes after the missile has been fired and its launch has been detected through various assets in South Korea and Japan and the United States. So there's a lot more risk involved to testing a missile about whether it's an whether it's real or whether it's an actual test than there is to these joint military exercises.
And David, I've often thought of North Korean nuclear technology in part as a defensive action, another thing to say, okay, here's a great reason not to attempt to invade North Korea. But I've seen some arguments that they could view these as an offensive capability, a first move if North Korea were to invade South Korea. What do you have concerns along those lines?
Yes, I think this is very important for listeners to understand that these, in my mind, these weapons have three different purposes. Okay, the first one is a defensive purpose. It makes it less likely that any country is going to invade North Korea when they have nuclear weapons. But I should be clear, that's not the only deterrent they have. Almost the entire city of Seoul is within artillery range and rocket-assisted artillery range of the DMZ. So they hold the city of Seoul hostage whether or not they have nuclear weapons. But it does serve a defensive purpose. It also could serve an offensive purpose if they would ever be interested in trying to reunify the Korean Peninsula, which, by the way, has been a consistent part of their propaganda since really 1948 and the creation of the DPRK. I happen to think that they are not too serious about that in the short term because they know that they would most likely be defeated easily by joint US-ROK forces if they attempted to do that. But I don't think the regime has ever disavowed that as a long-term goal. And if something would happen to split up the U.S. ROK alliance, I think many North Koreans would see that as a very positive development that could possibly make a unification by force more likely. And nuclear weapons would be very useful in that regard, especially as blackmail to encourage other countries to stay out of such a future conflict. And then finally, North Korean nuclear weapons are a tangible success story that the Kim regime can tell its people. Any North Koreans who were born, you know, prior to 1980, you cannot tell those people that they live better lives today than they did then because of the visionary leadership of Kim Jong-il or Kim Jong-un, because they don't. Their lives are materially poorer and more difficult in every single way. But what the Kim regime can say is we have developed these incredibly powerful weapons that make us a true player on the world stage and is the ultimate guarantee of the existence of our state and really of us as a race. And this is something that is incredibly valuable to the regime. I mean, they put these weapons on their postage stamps constantly. It's something that they can crow about. And I think it's an equal reason as to why they're developing. And in my mind, too, it's also a reason why they are unlikely to trade them away. What can the United States or the international community offer them that will be as valuable as nuclear weapons? We can offer them things that are perhaps as valuable as a deterrent, perhaps. But what can we offer them that meets these other two needs for the nuclear weapons?
One thing that has come from the outside world at points in history is food. North Korea had a major multi-year famine in the 1990s. I'm seeing reports that food insecurity is at the highest level there since then. And it just baffles me, David, at a fundamental level. A country that is unsuccessful at basic things like feeding its own citizenry, and yet having this highly advanced, very expensive missile and nuclear weapon technology, I my brain can't square that. How does it work?
Well, it's a choice. You know, it's unfortunately a choice that the regime has made. They could provide for their people. In fact, it wouldn't really take much more money. It would just take a little bit of liberalization in their economy, a little bit of liberalization in the kind of restrictions on movements and goods and people that exist in North Korea today. I mean, just opening up. Now, there are black markets everywhere in North Korea that operate kind of maybe more in a gray zone than a black zone. But even just making those markets legitimate would maybe address a lot of their food shortage issues. But, you know, North Korea is, you know, like anywhere else, they have droughts, they have floods, they have these natural disasters. But they're already, North Koreans are already living such a perilous existence that where another country could turn to the open market, you know, could turn to other places to get food, North Korea does not do this. And I think the reports that we're seeing just highlight the ongoing tragedy in North Korea, where 20 million North Koreans live in really dire circumstances, are food insecure and live in poverty. And it's very sad because it doesn't have to be that way. It is a choice. They could fix this. They have chosen to invest in other things. And the Kim regime has chosen to invest in a strategy to maintain its leadership that actually compels underdevelopment throughout North Korea. I firmly believe this is one of the ways that the regime maintains itself in power. It keeps the majority of the population too poor, too isolated, and too dedicated to their own search for subsistence to really have any desire or effort to begin to plan or think about alternatives to the Kim regime. It's really the divide and conquer strategy.
David Fields is with us from the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison, looking at the latest North Korean missile tests and U.S. relations with North and South Korea. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about North Korea, the Republic of Korea, U.S. relations with those countries, and the latest news? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with David Fields from the UW-Madison Center for East Asian Studies, looking at the U.S.-North Korea relationship after the latest threats and missile launches from North Korea. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Let's bring on a caller. Steve is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Steve.
Yes, hi. With all due respect, we're already in World War III with Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. You know, when the United States, when Biden administration ordered the blowing up of the Russia's oil pipeline
leading
into Germany, That was an act of war in violation of international law.
Okay, I'll stop you there, Steve. That is, there was that pipeline that blew up. Russia and some others have claimed that the United States was behind it. There are investigations. We don't know who blew it up at this point, David. But Steve's point, he thinks we're at a higher state of war with, or of tension anyway, with North Korea, Russia, and China. I don't know, what do you think?
I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, and I don't want to speak to the specifics of what the caller is saying, but I think these are times of heightened tensions. And I think when you look at the direction that global politics is going right now, there's a lot of reason to be somewhat concerned. And I think that's also a key part of the context in which North Korea is testing so many missiles. This is a very favorable international situation for them. The war in Ukraine is bringing Russia and China closer together, and it's pushing both of those countries further from the United States. And what that means for North Korea is they can engage in additional testing, and they're unlikely to suffer greater consequences for it because Russia and China is going to oppose greater sanctions in the UN Security Council, and they are very lax on imposing the sanctions that have already existed. So I think it's not a coincidence that they have been testing so many missiles in the last calendar year. Also, since May and June of last year, American intelligence, as well as South Korean intelligence, has been saying that a seventh North Korean nuclear test is imminent. It has not happened yet, but all the preparations have been made. And it's likely that it will probably happen sometime in the near future. And this is the perfect time to conduct that kind of test when the old coalition of the six party states that surround North Korea, including Russia and China, who used to cooperate on trying to rein in North Korean behavior, are not so interested in doing that anymore.
Speaking of Russia, there's some intelligence that North Korea has been supplying Russia, trading more with Russia since that invasion, including potentially ammunition for the Russian occupation of parts of Ukraine. Have you seen anything along those lines?
Yes, and there are reports coming from U.S. intelligence saying that, you know, ammunition, specifically artillery shells, is being transshipped from North Korea into Russia via third parties in the Middle East and Africa. We don't exactly know. They're not revealing how they know this. The North Koreans, for their part, are denying it, so it's not confirmed. But it would fit perfectly in line with North Korea's past behaviors. The North Korean regime, because of sanctions they're under, has a very difficult time getting hard currency. And so they are very creative at finding ways to finance themselves, including selling illicitly whatever they can find a buyer for, as well as engaging in insurance fraud, cyber theft, hacking, creating monumental statues in certain African republics. They're a very entrepreneurial nation. So while this isn't confirmed, it would not be surprising to me at all to know that this is the case. North Korea has a surplus of artillery shells that they don't have a particular immediate use for, and Russia has a use for those things. So it's not surprising at all if that would be the case.
Talking to David Fields from the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison, looking at the latest from North Korea. David, people have been paying a lot of attention to the succession who would take over in North Korea after Kim Jong-un. A lot of photos, a lot of public appearances with one of his daughters, whose name I understand we don't actually know. We have hints from Dennis Rodman. It's weird. You are skeptical, though, that we should read too much into this, I understand.
I am. And the name that gets kicked around is Kim Ju-ae, and that may well be her name. But our sole source for that is Dennis Rodman all the way back in 2013. So, again, it's one of those things that could be true, but is unverified. And yeah, her public appearance for the first time in November and then a series of appearances just this month has led to a lot of speculation that, Kim Jong-un's health has taken a turn for the worse, that this is an anointing of his chosen successor. All of that could be possible, but it is all speculation. Just why the North Koreans are doing this right now, there's a lot of theories. That's one of them. Another theory, and this is the one that I like a lot better, is Kim Jong-un is trying to bolster his image as a family man and bolster an image of him as a loving and caring parent. And if you look at what we could call the iconography of North Korean leaders, going from Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il, if you look at that, you'll realize that they do not present a hyper-masculine warrior king image to the world. Very different from, say, the image of Vladimir Putin, you know, dipping shirtless in an icy lake. That has never been the Kim style. They like to portray themselves as, in a much more fatherly way, often surrounded by children. And the idea is that they are the fatherly, loving leader of the entire nation. This has been part of their brand from the beginning. And, you know, nothing makes that easier for Kim Jong-un than appearing with his daughter, with his young daughter, whenever he feels the need to do so. I think it's a way to humanize him. And there are other theories out there as well, that maybe he just wants to raise his children differently than his father raised him. He was raised entirely outside the public eye. He wants to have a more normal family life in public. There's also the interesting idea that South Korean intelligence believes that he has other children, possibly a son, and that this son may be being educated in Europe quietly right now, the way he was educated. And so all the media attention on his daughter is maybe deflecting some interest in his other children. All of this is pure speculation, but I'm a big fan of Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is probably the best. And so the idea that this is a part of a media campaign to really bolster his image as a fatherly leader makes sense to me.
And you, David, are working on a book on Trump administration policy toward North Korea. The former president weighed in on his social media site. I'm going to quote here, Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who I got to know and got along with very well during my years as president, is not happy with the U.S. and South Korea doing big training and air exercises together. Trump goes on, he feels threatened, and then complained that South Korea doesn't pay the U.S. enough to do these military training drills. What do you make of that, as you're thinking a lot, I assume, about the Trump administration and North Korea?
Well, this has been something that Donald Trump has been saying about specifically South Korea for a very long time, that these training exercises are too expensive. He was clearly interested in trying to monetize the alliance when he was there, demanding that South Korea not only pay the costs of what it costs to put U.S. soldiers there, but pay beyond the costs. He was looking to make a profit out of the alliance. And I think it's pretty clear that he still thinks the same way today. And if he's reelected as president, he will probably pursue those policies again. I think it's quite possible that Kim Jong-un feels threatened by these military exercises. But as I said at the beginning of the broadcast, the United States and the ROK go out of their way to try to make these exercises as least threatening as possible. But, you know, the fact is that North Korea undertakes military exercises, missile tests all the time without any sort of warning. That is very threatening to its neighbors. And if, God forbid, something would happen on the Korean Peninsula, it's important that U.S. and ROK soldiers have these experiences of actually training together so they can operate effectively to meet any of those threats.
Briefly, as we wrap up, David, a lot of American presidents have tried a lot of different things when it comes to relations with North Korea. It seems to me sometimes that there's just not necessarily a right answer. Do you see any prospects for any kind of improvement?
Sadly, Rob, I don't. I think the best solution is try to keep your allies on sides, maintain a strong coalition for confronting North Korean behavior. Try to keep the cost for that behavior as high as possible, even though you know you cannot fundamentally stop them from doing what you want to do, and hope that you can prevent some sort of catastrophic conflict until some passage of time will make a solution possible. But in many ways, what Donald Trump did was radical, outside of the box thinking. If it would have worked, he deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. It didn't work. I think Joe Biden is returning to the conventional strategy. And I think there's not a lot of other opportunities out there.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's David Fields, Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison and author of Foreign Friends, Syngman Rhee, American Exceptionalism and the Division of Korea. He joined us for a look at the latest news from North Korea. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's a one-year anniversary of the expanded Russian invasion of Ukraine. We'll look at the impact of the Russian attack and Ukrainian resistance and what could come next. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to learn to cook Indian food with ingredients available in local stores. We'll talk to the author of the book, Six Spices, 60 Recipes. A couple of my favorite spices in there, too, and a couple that would broaden my cooking palate. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.